Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
Greetings, this is Kay Anderson-Shivers, and you're listening to The Tennis Podcast.
So thank you, Kay, for introducing this special edition of the Tennis Podcast. Kay is one of our guest editors in our Kickstarter campaign who helped to keep the Tennis Podcast going throughout the year. We've had 937 backers in 2019 who have pitched in to help us fund the show and to hire Grand Matt and to keep it going and to make it so that we can produce it every single week and daily at the Grand Slams. And Kay, you may remember, is Charlie the Ferret's mom. Charlie, our mascot of last year. He hasn't very well of late, so get well, Charlie. But we have a lot of questions here from our listeners to answer, and a few special ones from Kay as well. Catherine, are you ready?
Ready.
Blimey, she really does sound ready. Okay, let's just crack straight on, shall we? The first question that Kay has here: do you think WTA players who regularly ask for their coaches to come on court are damaging their chances of progressing in slams where they don't get the chance to ask for their coaches to come on?
Oh, there are so many layers to this question, Kay. Possibly, yeah. I mean, the boring factual answer is it depends on the player and the coach and their relationship. Not necessarily. But I think it's entirely possible for some players. I mean, there was that period, wasn't there, was it Rome, David, was it the Rome final where Simona Halep was struggling against Lina Svitolina and she didn't call Darren Cahill? There was certainly an event where Halep wasn't calling Darren Cahill onto court, and it was in preparation for the French Open where they wouldn't be able to. Am I imagining this? Put me out of my misery.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. That is what happened. And Darren Cahill has spoken quite openly in the past that he is a little concerned about the fact that a player, and in Simona Halep's case, quite a perfect example of such a player who may become over-reliant on a coach to come on and solve all their problems for them. And he did go through a period of saying, look, I want her to work it out for herself more often. And yeah, I mean, I personally think it is damaging. I think there is definitely the potential. I don't think it's guaranteed to be damaging. I mean, look at Caroline Wozniacki. She has her father come on every single set to talk to her, who he's her coach as well. And at the Australian Open, she managed to win without that. I think she's very strong mentally. And you know, different players are going to react differently, aren't they, depending on their personal mental and strategic skill sets. But I do feel it is absolutely possible that a player could end up treating a coach as a crutch that they mid-match can't do without, or find it more difficult to do without during slams.
Yeah, I agree. I think the answer is that it is absolutely possible. Obviously they're not officially working together anymore, Cahill and Halep, but you quite often used to see, even when she did call him down onto court, the first thing he would say is, well, what do you think? What do you think you need to do? What do you think is going wrong here or going right here? And I always really liked that about their dynamic in on-court interviews. And it, you know, look at Garbiñe Muguruza. She performs better at slams when she's not able to call Sam Sumic onto court. And I think, I don't think I've held back on the podcast before in saying that their on-court coaching exchanges make me feel really uncomfortable. I'm not sure they bring her any positive input at all. I think she brings him onto court because she can, and that's sort of just what she's in the habit of doing. And actually, that does her a lot of detriment in those events where it's happening. But then when she gets into slams, I mean, not necessarily recently, but when she gets into slams, suddenly she has to figure it out on her own, and she is more than able to, more than capable of it. And I think, yeah, I mean, I don't want to go off at too much of a tangent, but yeah, there's many layers of what's going on there. But then I think of other players, as you say, Caroline Wozniacki. There are plenty of examples of players where I think they're able to do that sort of in a vacuum. They do it because they can, but it's not the crutch, as you say, in the way that it might be for some others. I think it depends how much of an emotional element there is to calling the player onto court. How much are you just wanting a bit of tactical input, and how much are you doing it because you're in a tight spot and you want somebody to tell you that it's going to be okay, that you've got the thing within you that's going to make you able to turn it around. You know, we talked on the podcast a couple of weeks ago about imposter syndrome and personality types, particularly on the WTA side, personality types and players perhaps not believing that they belong. And I think for those sorts of personality types, hearing it from somebody else whose opinion you value is sadly sort of more significant than telling yourself that you're good enough or that you're a good enough player to win the match. Whether that is a bad thing in terms of transferring it into the slams, I don't know. I said at the beginning of the year that I was really eager for Halep and Sloane Stephens, the players without coaches, to have success without their coaches.
Yes.
And it's not happening for Sloane Stephens, is it?
No. I don't really know what makes Sloane Stephens tick well enough to know what that's down to. I mean, she does have a coach, or at least she has somebody with her. But
I don't think...
It's not the same, is it?
No, I don't think it's a coach in the way... Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm mistaken.
Kamau
about
Murray
that relationship.
Kamau Murray seemed everything, didn't he? He seemed to be life coach, tactician. He just seemed to really get her, and she responded. They didn't always get on, apparently, but for whatever reason, he was able to get the absolute best out of her, certainly enough in order to make her really successful. One other thing that does strike me as well is, and the other tangent to this is, it's perfectly possible that by having on-court coaching during the rest of the year, a player learns what they need to do in certain situations. So
yes,
it doesn't mean that because the coach can't come on during the slams that they can't think back to instances where they've called a coach on, learned what works for them, and just keep employing it.
Yeah, and say, okay, so I'm a set and 3-1 down. Oh, I remember when I was a set and 3-1 down in the semi-finals of Madrid, and whoever it might be, Dmitry Tursunov came on, and this is what he told me. I remember that. Maybe I'll do exactly what I was told to do then. You know, and it is striking how often, because what's in vogue with tennis and with coaching at the moment is just to focus on yourself, right? It's not about who you're playing necessarily in tactics of who you're playing. It's just focus on your game, do the right things for you, and you'll be good enough to win. So that being the case, the advice should be very transferable from match to match.
Did you see that, talking of Tursunov, did you see that coaching session where he just came on and didn't say anything?
He
just... It crouched next to her, and there was just silence.
sensational. I loved it.
Why?
Because of all the unspoken layers of what was going on, you know, he knew what she was wanting and expecting him to say, and he knew that it wasn't the right thing to say at that moment, and he was sort of, I don't know, it was just, I really like their relationship. I suspect they have massive Barneys, but always with an undercurrent of respect, don't you think?
Yes. Barneys, for our American listeners, arguments,
not
folks.
Dinosaurs.
Although, you know, I think you're right. I think, but it's also interesting is going to be how they react to the decline in her results recently. I mean, I know it's only a couple of months spell, but it has been underwhelming, really, for Sabalenka the last couple of months. I mean, I think when she made that breakthrough at the end of last year, we expected her to be the Andreescu. We expected her to maybe do an Osaka. Now, she may well still do over the next 6-8 months. But I am disappointed in her results the last 3 months, no question.
Me too, and I suspect she's disappointed in herself. And, yeah, I suspect she and Dmitry Tursunov both a little disappointing. I don't think she's an example, incidentally, of somebody that struggles at slams because they're not able to bring their coach onto court. But it's not a science. I could be wrong. I think
she redlines her game to such a degree that if it is off, you've got a problem. But it's going to be interesting to see her on clay now. I should say the reason we're doing we're doing a few of these listener question shows throughout the year.
Because they're great, David.
Well, they are great. I mean, they are absolutely amazing. This one, I mean, you've just had 10 minutes of it. You know, you tell us. This is why you listen. This is why you're going to tell all your friends to listen to the tennis podcast. However, as well, there's not an awful lot going on in the tennis world. So we try to spot openings within the calendar when there isn't a huge amount of events going on. Charleston this week. So we'll cover that in one of our future shows. But and that's green clay. But it is interesting, isn't it? That transference onto the new surface. You mentioned Osaka the other day. It's just so interesting to watch how these players are going to adapt. Just on the coaching, given that nobody seems to be able to agree on whether to have coaching on the side of the court, on-court coaching, headset coaching, no coaching at all, do you think it matters that there is difference in that way? Or do you think we have to find a single way of running the game whereby it's the same all the time?
Yes, it matters a lot that there's so much difference. I hate it. I hate it. I care more about it all being uniform and men's and women's tennis and slams and tour level events agreeing on what's the best way forward than I do about whether there should or shouldn't be on-court coaching. I just want it all to be the same. As it happens, as time goes on, I'm coming down more on the side of yes, thumbs up to on-court coaching, but I wouldn't defend it at the expense of potential equity in the game across events and across tours. That is the hill that I will die on for tennis.
I think we went for headset coaching as our number one. At least I think that after the Next Gen, the original inaugural Next Gen event, that's where I felt
It worked well.
Comfortable.
Yeah, it worked well. Plus, you get the amusing bonus feature of seeing players sat there in sort of futuristic headsets, which is brilliant. And it opens up technologically, from a broadcast point of view, you get better quality audio. There's no risk of the player being or the coach being off mic or anything like that. And it opens a lot more, or it ought to make it a lot more possible to provide translations, which for me is absolutely key. I think it's laughable, the situation we have at the moment. And David, I think you deal with it brilliantly in your commentary on BT, when you have what looks like an absolutely gripping on-court coaching exchange. And as a commentator, you just have to say, well, it looks like we've just had an absolutely gripping and insightful on-court coaching exchange. I can't tell you anything that was said in it, because unfortunately it happened in Kazakh. But yeah, if you do speak Kazakh out there, fill your boots. It is ludicrous. It is absolutely ludicrous. Yes. And so I know it takes money to resolve, but I can't think of money better spent. You know, if a job's worth doing, do it properly. If you're going to stand by having on-court coaching, and I think there are lots of things going for it, and it is something that you can... I see a lot of arguments in opposition as well, but if you're going to stand by it, do it properly.
Hmm. Well, I agree. I think we're in agreement. Right, so there we are. Kay, there's your first question. That took 14 minutes to answer. Hope you enjoyed it. Here's your second one. Is it better for the sport to have four outstanding players who dominate, or have a range of players competing more evenly? And I suppose you would look particularly at the women's tour just at the moment, where we've had, 14 different champions at the first 14 events of the year. And whereas obviously in the men's tour, and to a historical extent in the past in the women's tour, when you had Serena particularly dominating, what do you prefer? What do you think is better for the sport?
It's such a pertinent question. And in fact, there is an article examining exactly that conundrum by Charlie Eccleshare in today's Telegraph.
Is there?
There is. The headline is, Tennis equitability this year has been thrilling, but when does a sport become too unpredictable?
Oh, that's a great headline. I'm going to read that.
I literally read it about half an hour ago, and then I saw Kay's list of questions, and I thought, hang on a second, maybe you should be writing in the Telegraph.
Everybody go and read Charlie's article immediately after you finish listening to this podcast, and obviously downloaded all the rest of our back catalogue. But Catherine, what's the gist of what he came to?
That basically the big four era in the men's game over the past 10 years has provided the paradigm for perfection in terms of level of competition, which I'd say it's true. He says defining precise parameters for what makes a sporting era great is not easy, but there are a few common themes. Most obvious is that having one dominant team or individual is rarely much fun. See Pete Sampras or Liverpool in the 70s, Man United in the 90s. The idea that monopolies like these are bad is so entrenched in our sporting subconscious, and this is a really interesting point, that in America, active steps have been taken to prevent them. For a nation that is the poster child of free trade capitalism, their almost communist attitude to sport remains a curiosity, but that is the situation in the NFL, where the selection order for the all-important college draft is determined by reversing the previous season's rankings. I found that really fascinating. So that's the sort of interventionist attempt to even things up and not perpetuate domination by the top teams.
Yeah, you don't get that at all in Premier League football in the UK, do you? And you see, I've been watching a lot of NFL over the last year and hearing about the draft and the way they do it, just as you've described there. And I'm really fascinated now to watch the draft, just to see what this rubbish team might get in terms of this amazing player, like, you know, coming in to just join
and
them.
Does the amazing players sort of have a look of disappointment on their face, like, oh, I was hoping to go to the Miami Dolphins and I'm off to, like, Utah?
Utah don't have an American football team, however.
Do they not?
They have an NBA team there, Catherine, so we'll go with that.
Hang on. How do you know that? Is that true?
What would the Utah team's name be in American football? The Utah...
Salt Lake City... Saracens.
Okay. Think of a name for Utah.
I'm Googling,
folks.
David.
At Tennis Podcast.
Keep talking. I'm Googling.
Bit off topic. Utah Jazz in NBA, I should add. Which doesn't really roll off the tongue in quite the way I was hoping it would. But anyway, what do I think about it? Is it better to have the four outstanding players who dominate, or depth? Oh, it's such a tough one to answer, because I'm thoroughly enjoying the variety at the moment on the women's circuit. I really am. But ultimately, I do feel a sport benefits from having an ongoing narrative and soap opera type feel. I mean, we see in boxing at the moment, which is excruciating in the way it makes its biggest performers avoid each other. At the moment, you've got Tyson Fury, Anthony Joshua, and Deontay Wilder just having fights against other people when all anybody wants to see is them fight each other. In tennis, I think sometimes we almost have too much of a good thing. The fact that you've had over 40 or 50 matches between Djokovic and Nadal, maybe it's important for them to be missed occasionally. But I'd rather have it that way. I'd rather see the best taking on the best regularly. And therefore, I think it's difficult for us as media, and I think it's more difficult for fans generally to invest in a player who isn't doing it very often, and to try to get excited about somebody, and they have a big achievement, and then they just go missing. I think you only have to look at the rude health that the tennis is in at the moment, and I do think it is in great condition, and think that those dominating players, as long as there's a group of them, one on their own, I agree. Michael Schumacher back in the day, I think was problematic. Tiger Woods was effective. I mean, as a sport leader, but I do think a group is the best.
Yeah, an oligopoly, as Charlie says.
Yes.
He uses the wonderful, he ends on the wonderful analogy of the WTA Tour rolls on this week in Charleston and Monterey with the prospect of a 15th and 16th winner of 2019. The chaos has been thrilling, but like a teenager left to their own devices, suddenly yearning for their parents to come home, it's time for some sort of order to be restored.
Yes, well said, Charlie. Oh, that's a good piece. Can't wait to read the whole thing. So, next question from Kay. Is it unfair for a top player to enter 250 events where they are likely to dominate just so they can hit milestones? I think Kay is pointing towards Roger Federer here.
I love how loaded this question is, David.
Yeah, Roger Federer is on 101 titles, and we were last week talking about him entering Newport, the grass court event after Wimbledon, just to notch up another one. I mean, I don't think it's unfair at all because they are eligible. And should the rules change? I don't think they should. I think that is a fair dividing line. Much as I was pleased for Kyle Edmund to get some form going in that challenger the other week, I thought him being a top 30 ranked player entering a challenger tournament was, that had a slightly unfair ring to it. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it's an arbitrary dividing line, but one between tours certainly seems the place to put it to me. I have to say, the point hadn't even occurred to me that it might be unfair for Roger Federer to enter Newport. I mean, it's so...
Well, it's not.
No, it's not. But it hadn't even occurred to me that it might be. That's how not unfair.
Yes.
I think it is. 250 events, the entry list to 250 events are, the factors that go into the players that enter are so not about competition. You know, it's appearance fees and it's what else have you got going on? Yeah, you'll have players trying to get their ranking up to get their ranking up to whatever it might be, other milestones, you know, to get into the seeded positions for slams, to get main draw entry into slams, or if they know they've got a lot of points to defend from that week, so they're going to drop in the rankings. There's all sorts of very personal motivations that go into players entering where they enter, players coming back from injury, and I think whatever your personal motivations are as a tennis player, within the rules, play wherever you like. And I don't think it's fair on the events to say, well, you're a piddly little 250, so you're consigned to only having players ranked outside the top 50. Isn't that what makes them really exciting, when you have a couple of the really big guys? And I object to the concept, really. I mean, maybe it all should be a bit more transparent and scientific, you know, the motivations for players entering. Appearance fees, as we've spoken before on one of the listener question shows, is an area of tennis which is really murky. And it goes on most at 250 and 500 level, because obviously they're the non-mandatory tournaments to get those, to lure those big guys to play. Finances inevitably are a factor, but yeah, perhaps they could be a bit more transparency. But apart from that, I think it's all fair game, really. And I can't think of anything better than seeing Roger Federer play in Budapest in 2020 to try and get himself over the line.
Imagine if he was entering a succession of 250s and he just couldn't get the win.
Kept on losing to, like...
How low can he go?
I won't pluck a name at risk of having fans of that person text in, but insert name here. Gilles Muller coming out of retirement. There we go.
Go on, Gilles.
I'll use your example.
Yeah. Right. Now, are there any new rule changes that you'd like to see trialled at this year's Next Gen tournament, Catherine? Case final question before we get on to a few other people.
Oh, haven't they pretty much trialled all of them?
I've got three.
Crikey. Okay. Do you ever sleep, David, or are you just lying in bed or thinking about rule changes that they could trial at the Next Gen tournament? Go for it.
And podcast ideas. And yeah, that's basically what I do, is think of stuff to do with this show. Well, I've actually just thought of two off the top of my head. One of which is to only give players one serve. I'd love to see a tournament. I'd love to see what would happen. There's a jeopardy to it, which I love. Do you go for it or do you not? And so I'd love to see a single serve used. The other one I think is just obvious, which is just do not allow aborted ball tosses. If the ball's in the air, it has to be struck. You can't just catch it and do it again, otherwise you lose your serve.
That's very bad news for me.
Why do you think I've brought it up? And I don't know whether you'd do this for Next Gen, because this feels like the wrong way around in a way, but I'd love to see a tournament played with just wooden rackets. But it feels like it needs to be a different generation, not the next
generation. Only over 40s or over 45s suggest that ever, David.
Oh, wouldn't you love to see it, though? See what would happen?
I imagine it would be a bit rubbish, though, wouldn't it?
Why? I was talking to Joe Jury about it.
Because they wouldn't be very good at it. They wouldn't be very good at it.
But that's the point. Find out who's got
Maybe if they played year-round and they all had a chance to adjust. But I think tournament, it would be varying degrees of rubbish.
But that's the beauty of it, to find out who's got the
ability.
Watching
rubbish tennis, that's what I look for.
I want to know which players have got the ability to find the sweet spot from a racket that has such a small sweet spot. I was talking to Joe Jury about it during the Ash Barty final commentary in Miami, and I said that I think that Ash Barty would have put together a pretty decent career back in her day. And she said, well, I think she's put in a pretty decent career together now. I said, yeah, but I think there are not all players that could cope with wooden rackets. And she described what it was like she said she had a go with a wooden racket recently, and realizing the size of the sweet pot, she doesn't know how she used to do it. I'd just love to know who's got that ability to adapt the quickest. Mm. Anyway, but I think my one serve rule is the one that I'd most like to see trialled. And actually, in many ways, I'd probably like to remove a couple of the other rules, and just because there's so much thrown at it every year, I almost feel like saying, well, those ones didn't work. Well, I'd get rid of the sets to four. Yeah, I don't like that at all. So I'd get rid of that and go back to normal sets.
And no ad scoring?
Yeah, I like the ads. I mean, make it one set if you want, but
all timed. This is something that Daniela and Greg were talking about in the Amazon studio. Make it timed. You play for an hour.
Yeah, that's an
whoever's in
one.
The lead wins.
Yeah, that might be good.
I mean, I know you've got issues with whoever serves first obviously has too big an advantage in that scenario, so you'd have to mitigate for that. You could do sort of badminton or squash or table tennis type serve scoring?
I think there's too much Hawkeye challenging going on generally. I'd quite like to see tournaments with one go at it. Or you know, maybe two, or not keeping them if you get it right. Just, you know, you've got a couple of chances, and if you're adamant that it's out, you use it. If not, tough. So there we are. Yeah. What have you got? Anything?
No, there's some I'd do away with, as you said. I mean, I feel really strongly about getting rid of the knock-up.
Yes,
really strongly.
Yes, I agree.
I think it is
that should
ludicrous.
Go altogether. There should be no knock-up.
And I had a heated debate with Daniela and Greg about it because they thought it was an awful idea. They said, no, it would just be, you have no idea how hard it would be, you know, to go out and play without having knocked up. And I said, yeah, but it would be the same for your opponent as well. So I don't care whether it's hard. Yes, it might make the first couple of games of a match suffer a little in quality, but I'll take that. You know, that's for me, that's not too big a price to pay. You know, boxers don't have just a little spar against one another. Can you imagine? But that is the equivalent.
Take each other's head off a few times.
Let's just have a little punch before we get going with the main event. Ludicrous. Absolutely ludicrous. Yeah. And you have, you know, the events where you have the huge build-up and the walk-on music and the lights are down, they step on court, and then, suck all the air out of the arena by having a 10-minute little
like playing the,
little
the,
hit, hit
the sort of sport that we play, which, I mean, people don't pay to go and see that.
It's absurd.
Yes.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. A question from our Facebook page, The Tennis Podcast, if you want to like us on Facebook, which Kay has picked out from Richard Glanville, who says, what are the upsides and the downsides of working long hours every day during a tournament? I think this means towards us. Do you ever miss the experience of attending tournaments purely as fans?
Yes, Richard, I do. No need to get the violins out. But if there is a downside to the job that we do, then yeah. And I'm not sure I'll ever be able to have that pure fan experience again. There's sort of no going back. Not to say that I can't buy a ticket and go as a fan, but it will never feel exactly as it used to. I don't think, and that's a minor shame. I mean, obviously there are tremendous upsides, which counteract all of that. But yes, is the short answer to attending his fans. In fact, I really wanted to be able to go to the upcoming Fed Cup tie with Kazakhstan as a fan, but unfortunately it clashes with Monte Carlo, and I'll be in the Prime studio covering the latter stages of that, which, again, not suggesting anyone get violins out. I'm very, very happy to be doing that. But, yeah, it is a minor footnote of sadness.
Yeah, I would concur. I think there's a couple of points. One is it's really hard to go, for us, I find anyway, to go to a tournament which I'm not working at. I just don't really know what to do with myself. Find myself, if I'm sitting there watching in the crowds, I find myself looking at the commentators, looking at the people that are doing the on-court interviews, looking at the people that are organising the on-court interviews, because those are all things that I do for a living. And just, I suppose, assessing what they're doing, imagining what I'd do in that situation, and I'm not concentrating enough on the pure fan experience at all. And
do you get worried about being caught on camera as well?
Well,
I do. And you're bigger than me, so you should be worried about that.
But I'm too fidgety. And I mean, I'm worse now that Twitter's come along, because I actually was at an event not that long ago where I didn't really have a working capacity. I found myself on my phone all the time, which is terrible. I mean, that's awful. I wish I'd left that at home. But I think the other thing is, I have lost the ability to care as a fan for a player. I don't support a player, which professionally is good. I'm really glad that's the case. I don't feel biased towards any player or anything like that. I feel warmth towards a certain player, but for whatever reason.
David, Grigor Dimitrov.
No, but I mean, yeah, all right. Okay, a bit of him, and there's one or two that I do have, but you know, the professionalism outweighs all that.
Yeah.
I don't have that same. I used to love watching Ivan Lendl, and I used to love watching Pete Sampras when I was younger, and really support them. And then the moment I met Pete Sampras and asked him to do an interview and he told me to get lost, that all disappeared, frankly, quite quickly. And when I first became a freelance reporter after leaving the ATP as a communications manager, I went for BBC Radio to a press conference at my favourite football team, West Bromwich Albion, and I interviewed the manager, Gary Megson, which had my knees knocking, because he was an absolute hero of mine. And I suppose a bit like a father who employs one of his kids for the summer, I ended up going in really hard on him and asking him really tough questions, which made it a very uncomfortable interview. And I came out of it thinking, well, I've done a good job, but I feel terrible. I feel awful. You know, I've just made one of my heroes squirm. And I don't like that feeling. So I don't really want to work in football again. You know, I've commentated on a couple of games, but generally speaking, I can just be a fan of that, and I'm glad, because I don't want to lose that fan experience. So there we are.
If only you'd done that during the Tony Pulis era.
Yeah,
you might be working in football as we speak.
I wouldn't mind going and asking them why they sacked Darren Moore. Anyway, tennis podcast listeners don't want to know about all this. They want to know about what Nick Whittaker's about to ask, which is,
hang on, we haven't answered the other element of Richard's question.
The upsides and downsides of working long hours.
Sleep, Richard, sleep. No yes. Time for napping.
Well, no.
For David, that's an upside. For me, it's a downside. Done.
Catherine and I have slightly different needs, sleep-wise.
No. That is not the correct assessment, David. We, as human beings, have the same needs, but I'm more in touch with them than you are. You're yes. In denial.
I forget, and then I suffer. One day in the tournament, I suddenly realise the errors of my ways.
Yeah.
And that actually human beings do require sleep in order to function.
It's not pretty.
No, Catherine has to then put up with that 24-hour period. Nick Whittaker asks, who are the best...
Give his surname, David. It's a great surname.
Nick Whittaker asks, who are the best over 25-year-old players on both tours and still playing? to have not won a Grand Slam title, in your opinion? And do you think they will win one?
Is over 25. That's quite a low youth bar, isn't it? 25.
Do we think Milos Raonic... I'll throw some at you. Milos Raonic, is he going to win a slam?
I'm losing faith in Milos Raonic.
He's not going to win a slam?
Probably not, no.
I don't think so either, no. Grigor Dimitrov?
Nope, sorry.
No, I don't think so either.
Kei Nishikori? Nope.
No. on the women's side, who hasn't won a slam? Kiki Bertens, is she over 25?
Ooh. She broke through quite late, didn't she? So I suspect she might be. Stand by, Google is happening.
I think it's not impossible.
She's 27, David.
Yeah. I think she could win the French Open.
She could win the French, yeah.
Yeah.
But if I had to commit to it...
I wouldn't put money on it. I'd say less than 50-50.
Yeah, agreed. But I'd rather have my money on her than on Raonic, Dimitrov or Nishikori.
Yes.
Sadly.
Anybody else that could win a slam that's over 25? I'm just looking at the women's list more than the men's list.
We've got
list
to think
really
of somebody
here
that we would put money on. Come on.
I can't really think. Looking at all these names on this list, I can't see it, really. Not really?
Hang on, are you looking at women's or men's?
How's Karolina Pliskova? She's 27. She could win one.
Yeah.
She could win one.
She's 27 years old.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I know. I thought she was about 22.
Elina Svitolina's not that age yet, is she? She's 24, maybe?
No, yeah, I definitely think Pliskova could, because she's building that base. She's quarterfinals all the way and better this year.
Agreed. But she's a former world number one. It's hardly an out there prediction.
No, but she is one who hasn't done it.
Should we try and think of a man?
No.
It's not even worth looking. That's how unlikely it is.
I can't think of anybody that hasn't already. I mean, I don't think Thomas Burdick's going to do it now.
No.
Let us know at Tennis Podcast if you can think of anybody over 25 who hasn't won a slam already, that is still playing, that you think could win a slam.
Dominic Thiem's 25.
Is he?
Yeah, I think
he's going to win one. Yeah, he's going to win one, isn't he?
He said over 25, though. Do you think that counts?
Don't know. Let us know, Nick. Does that count or not? Anyway. Right, next
John
one.
John Isner?
John Isner's not going to win a slam. I don't think.
Do I'm you? No, I don't think.
Yeah,
okay. But he'd probably be my next. I'd put him ahead of Dimitrov. Sorry.
Leave Grigor alone. Oh, I'd love to go back and have a chat with our 2012 just started the tennis podcast selves and tell them in 7 years' time, folks,
we were ignorant fools, David.
Oh, dear. Still love
Luca
you, Grigor.
Luca Puy is 25? No.
Can't see him winning one. No. The big racket.
Fernando Verdasco, 35.
He might win the 35 in overs. the big racket asks, which players have disappointed you most in 2019 and why? This is our final question from this listener's questions edition.
Well, Aryna Sabalenka, as you mentioned, that you've already she's getting a big mention under disappointments twice in one podcast. But given that I had her in my finals for the Australian Open, she has let me down and has subsequently let me down. I still believe, and she's still incredibly young. But as you say, it will be very interesting to see how she deals with these troubles. Very interesting indeed. She's 20 years old, so time is on her side, but that's still 2 years older than Bianca Andreescu, isn't it? And I think it's tough for these young players that have been so talked up to suddenly, they've spent months, if not years, being told the world is at their feet. It's just a matter of time. You're the big thing. All the sponsors are coming to you, offering you the world. And then suddenly you get overtaken by someone 2 years younger than you any amount younger than you. I think that must be incredibly difficult to deal with. I think it probably irritate Sasha Zverev no end.
Alexander Zverev would be my pick. And I know he hasn't been very well recently, etc. But
oh, he's had a cold, David. I know a cold can be miserable, don't get me wrong. I feel so sorry for myself when I have a cold. But how many times will Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Murray, all of them have had a cold like that and we just won't have known about it? Whereas we have known so much about it with Sasha Zverev. That's what worries me. It's okay to have a cold and to feel miserable and to play badly and to lose, but I just don't want to hear so much about his cold. Obviously, if it turns out that the cold is something more sinister, I'm going to feel dreadful. But as it stands at the moment, he's had a cold and I just don't want to hear about it anymore.
Yeah, he would be mine because we know the raw materials are there. We keep getting told they are. He has added Ivan Lendl to his team. He has produced on the Masters 1000 stage so many times. He's 3 in the world. He's won the ATP finals. He's done all the things you're meant to do before breaking through. And he hasn't broken through at the very highest level. One quarterfinal produced so far. And that performance against Miloš Raonic was so substandard and feeble. Against a very good Miloš Raonic, I should say.
He didn't have a cold then.
I think I even heard a bit of injury talk about that match as well. But I don't care really, because that should not have happened. The way he fell away, the dramatic way he lost those first two sets, it's just not good enough. And so he would definitely be my biggest disappointment so far. So there we are, Catherine. That
what
concludes
a perky note to end on.
That concludes an edition, a listener's questions special edition here on the Tennis Podcast, with questions selected by our special editor, guest editor Kay Anderson Chivas. Thank you very much for those
questions. Thank you, Kay.
Thank you for sending them in. We will be back with another one of these very, very soon. Might even be next week. And then we'll be back into the weekly chat about the tennis circuit as it really gets heating up over the clay court season and into the grass. We're going to have daily editions during the French Open and at Queens and during Wimbledon. You know, you're going to have plenty of us to get your teeth into on the Tennis Podcast. Hope you're enjoying the show. Do make sure you let people know if you are at a tennis club, if you play yourself. Let people know that we are here and that people can listen to us and that they can have their daily and weekly fix of the Tennis Podcast. And thank you for listening as well. We have been executive produced by tennisballs.com. Our mascot this year is Rio with a Y. We are produced in association with The Telegraph, and Catherine and Matt Roberts and myself will be back very soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.